The topic of this lecture is economics of the public sector. And there's certainly an awful lot that can be said about this. And so I'm going to try to make as many points as I can fit in about it in the time that we have, and then hopefully leave some time at the end for questions. But as far as the application of economics to understanding the public sector, economists have been doing this for a long time. If you read an economics book, a Principles of Economics book, from the time of Adam Smith until about, I think, the 1940s, the title was probably Principles of Political Economy, because of the understanding that governments have always been involved in the economies of countries, and you can't really fully understand economics unless you understand, to some extent, the interaction between the economy and the state. And that sort of changed beginning the early to mid 20th century, when economists thought of themselves more as scientists and began studying markets using more and more math, for example. And they seemed to drop this idea that you really had to understand the interaction between the state and the economy. But once again, the Austrians never did that. The Austrians always understood this. You look at look through von Mises' books or Hayek's books. Hayek's Law, Legislation, and Liberty, Volume 3, is all about sort of the economic analysis of political behavior, and so is von Mises wrote a book in the 1940s entitled Bureaucracy, the application of Austrian economics to the study of government bureaucratic decision making, but the rest of the economics profession has sort of forgotten about that. And what ruled the roost in the economics profession during the 1940s, 50s, and 60s was mathematical theories of market failure. And so they just assumed markets fail, and then assumed government will perfectly fix the failures of markets. And there was a bit of a revolution in economics beginning in the late 60s. That was known as the public choice revolution, and some of my professors were the key players there. I was a student of James Buchanan and Gordon Tullock at Virginia Tech way back when the dinosaurs still roamed the earth, at least in Southwest Virginia anyway, when I was in graduate school. And they were among the people who revived, among mainstream economists, the study of the application of economics to the study of government. But as I already said, the Austrians didn't need to be revived. They always wrote about the interaction between the state and the government. Look at Mises' book, National Economy. It's in Human Action. It's in Socialism, published in the 1920s. It's all about the operations of governments under socialism, for example. The next lecture that I have at 4 o'clock with Walter Block, we're going to critique the public choice contributions from an Austrian perspective. But for now, I just want to make some points about how we use economic reasoning to go about understanding how governments work. Because as imperfect as everything on this earth is imperfect, nothing is perfect or heaven-like, but as imperfect as markets are, government is infinitely more imperfect, if you will. And the first point I'd like to make is something that's been understood for a long time, but it was formalized and written up in the language of mainstream economics by the public choice people. Actually, the first person to talk about this was a political scientist named Anthony Downs, the first person to talk about it in the modern era. Of course, the Romans talked about democracy and how democracies worked and didn't work, so a lot of this is very old. But there's this model that was developed among the public choicers. Some of you may be familiar with this. It had to do with the median voter. And I'm starting with this because this is a good way to think about government failure of government. The big critique of markets, among the big critiques of markets that the mainstream of the economics profession makes is, there are externalities. Pollution is usually cited as an externality. On the positive externality side, they claim that people don't invest enough in their own education, therefore we need government subsidies for education, because your education benefits society as a whole as well as you, the argument goes. Therefore, you don't have enough of an incentive to educate yourself because you don't take into consideration the benefits to other people of your education. That's the argument. But as a counter to these ideas that markets create externalities or external effects, this median voter model explains how it's inherent in democracy that every political decision in a democracy creates externalities, political externalities, if you will. They're called political externalities. I think it was my old professor, James Buchanan, who coined that phrase, political externalities. And the model is pretty simple. It starts with a straight line. How's that? That's an Austrian graph. That's an Austrian use of graphs. And the way this model has been explained for a long time, since the 1950s, is they used to use left and right in terms of political preferences. That's the way they usually look at it. But I prefer to look at this as, on the left, as totalitarianism over here on this end. And over here is Walter Block. Okay, so you have total government control of everything over here on the far left, and then no government at all on the far right point on this line, and the distribution of voters is a bell curve, and this what this is measuring is political preferences for the size of government, and the median voter is in the middle of the road here. Here's the median voter. And so there are relatively a few totalitarians here. There's Paul Krugman right there. People like that, okay. And you'd have, let's see over here, I don't know. But we'll leave Walter over there by himself. But the most people are middle of the road. These are the people Rush Limbaugh complains about all the time, middle of the roaders. And so the way the model originally was set up is, if there's an election, say a presidential election, and one candidate stakes out, call this B1 for Block 1, he or she gives speeches and it goes on television, and the people perceive that person as being about here philosophically, and the other person, T1, is here, the totalitarian candidate. If you look at the midpoint between T1 and B1, dotted line, there's more area under the bell curve to the left than there is to the right, so that the totalitarian candidate will win. So what do you suspect the Blockian candidate would do in response to that if the election wasn't until 2 months from now? Move to the left, right? Start praising the benefits of the welfare state, and so forth. Promise to give old people free pharmaceuticals, things like that. Move to the left. And so B1 might move, all the way over here, B2. And so then if the election were held, here's the midpoint now, this dotted line, and there's more room under the bell curve to the right. And so the model says, what happens is whoever does the best job of positioning himself closest to the median will win the election, on election day. It also claims to explain big landslides, like when Barry Goldwater lost the American election in 1964, he is said to have been perceived way out here, a dangerous right winger. And also when Reagan won in a huge landslide, 49 out of 50 states in 1980, Jimmy Carter was seen to be way over here, too far to the left. He's a bad politician. Bill Clinton was a real pro at this. I don't know how there might be a few people who remember Bill Clinton, but his whole campaign, his first time around, he was doing things like recommending school uniforms in the public schools and sounding very conservative. He was on a stage once with a well-known female rapper, and he turned around and shook his finger at her and chastised her for being too dirty-mouthed, too foul-mouthed in her lyrics, even though she was there to support him and raise money for him. And so he was moving to the center. He was trying to act more conservative, and he was as good as anybody at doing that.
But there was three candidates then.
Yeah. Well, I don't want to get into details of that. The crazy Ross Perot was around too, but I'm just saying he was a pro at centering himself in the middle. But the main lesson of this is that any decision in a democracy of this sort is going to make people on the left wing here very unhappy, because government is far too small as far as they're concerned, and it's going to make a lot of people over here in the country as big as the U.S., many millions of people, unhappy because government is too big for that from their perspective. And these are the political externalities, because the nature of government decision making is all or none. When you have an election, you only have one result. You can't say Bill Clinton is my president and Ross Perot is your president. Somebody wins in politics. Whereas in the market, if I want to drink Diet Coke and you want to drink beer, well, that's fine. You can have your beer, I can have my Diet Coke. We don't take elections. Just if we use democracy to determine what we're going to drink and beer wins, well, then everybody would have to be drinking beer all the time. Or if we use democracy to decide what size of shoe you're going to wear. And what if for men, it's what if size 6 triple E wins for men? Everybody would be walking around with sore feet, except for the guys with tiny little hoof-like feet, size 6 triple E. But that's how democracy works. It's all or none decision making. And so built into that is every single thing government does creates political externalities. And so that is one point about just the operation of any democracy. It's going to create a great deal of unhappiness on the part of a lot of people all the time. We'll always do that. Just look at education. Educational policy is determined by democracy. And in the United States, they've determined that there's no praying allowed in public schools. That's what the majority has created in their decision. But in private schools, if you want to pray in school, you can pray. You go to private school. There's no conflict at all there. There's no negative externality for people who want to be able to pray in at school, before the school day every day. But you try to do that in most public schools, and it's a huge national crisis. But it's because of democracy. Another aspect of democracy and government is the importance of log rolling. And what log rolling does is, or vote trading, creates a situation of where governments inherently spend a lot more than even what the majority wants. For example, if you had three groups of voters, Group A, Group B, and Group C, with different preferences. Let's say there's equal numbers of people in a particular city, Group A, Group B, and C, and Group A wants more government spending, say by the county government or the state government, on schools. This would be people with school-age children, let's say, but no more on hospitals. That's another thing that local governments often provide is hospitals. They run hospitals. Most hospitals in the U.S. are run by local governments. In fact, it's something like Milton Friedman did a study of this some years ago. He said something like 80% nowadays of all hospitals are government-run. 20% or so are private, either nonprofit, private, or for-profit, private. Group B wants more spending on hospitals. This is, say, older people whose children are grown out of school. They don't care that much about schooling anymore, but they care about their health, so they want more hospital spending, but none on schools. And Group C is satisfied with the status quo. That is, they prefer no more spending on schools and no more spending on hospitals, because you have to raise their taxes to do either, to some extent. And so the question is, if you have a proposal for more school spending, and you need a majority, you need 2 out of 3 in my example. You need 2 out of 3. Let's say the voting rule in this area requires a 2/3 majority, just for the sake of example. Would it be possible to get 2 out of 3 if there's a proposal, a referendum, for more school spending? Just looking at this. No, you don't have 2 out of 3. How about more hospital spending? Because you only have 1 out of 3 for that. And so that would be the true preferences of the people. Status quo wins. But what log rolling is this group can say, well, we don't give a crap about hospitals spending, but we will vote for more hospital spending, Group B, if you, who don't give a crap about more school spending, promise to vote for more school spending when our vote comes around. And so that's log rolling or vote trading. And this takes place in legislatures all the time, for example. And so even though the true preferences of the community is the status quo, the actual result, which is no more spending on anything, the actual result is more spending on everything, more government spending on everything. There's schools and hospitals win. And this happens every day in Congress. You'll have the congressman from New York City voting in favor of farm subsidies, even though he or she does not have one farmer in his district in New York, because there's been a promise that when the urban spending bill comes up, the congresspeople from Kansas and Nebraska and Iowa will vote for the urban spending bill, even though it won't benefit any of their constituents at all. And so that's vote trading or log rolling. And it's inherent in all democracies. And it's one of the things that creates more government than the people want. So even this median voter model, it suggests that at least the majority gets what they want. But government has devised all sorts of gimmicks and techniques over the years to guarantee that that isn't necessarily true. Another sort of trick that governments have put into play is something called agenda control. That is, if governments can control what it is you're voting on, they can manipulate the outcome. One technique that is used of agenda control is, you see this, I'll give you a personal example that I can remember from years ago. I lived in Buffalo, New York for a short time, and they held a referendum on increased school spending. And they proposed the raising taxes for a certain amount, for supposedly for more school spending, and it got voted down three times. And so they kept going. They planned a fourth vote on increased school spending, but they waited until school started in September. Then they waited until it started snowing in October. This is Buffalo, New York. It usually snows from October through May in Buffalo, every day, all day long, with high winds to go along with it. And they said, well, we don't have enough money for school buses. And so, and in Buffalo, at least the year I lived there, there was no such thing as a sidewalk from about November till April, because all the snow plows kept snow plowing all the snow and so on. So, and it's a winter, so it's dark when the kids are going to school. So they're pretty much saying, well, your kids are going to walk to school in the dark on the street if you don't vote for the school spending. And so they took another vote, and of course it passed. So they have their ways of manipulating the agenda of voting. And there's one sort of famous example of this. It's called the Washington Monument Syndrome. It's named the Washington Monument Syndrome because it was perfected by the head of the National Park Service in the 1960s when Congress was threatening to not give the National Park Service in the U.S. the budget it was requesting. And so the head of the National Park Service closed down the Washington Monument in Washington, D.C. He didn't have to. He didn't have to, but he did. And all of a sudden, members of Congress from every state were getting very angry letters from constituents and phone calls saying, we went on our family vacation to Washington, D.C., and the first thing we wanted to do was to go up the elevator in the Washington Monument, and it's closed. And so Congress caved in and gave them their money. They closed down the Washington Monument. And that's why it's called the Washington Monument Syndrome. But what usually happens is, they do like the Buffalo example. The first thing to go would be ambulance services, garbage collection, police services. Even though it's totally unnecessary to do that, they do that. And so they can force either a referendum or a non-cutting of spending. But, well, I don't know. I don't know if Congress can do that as far as that goes. It's an executive branch thing. I mean, yeah. The head of the National Park Service is appointed by the president, and so it would have to be the president who would be doing this. So I don't know. I don't know the inside. I don't know exactly what happened. It might have been maybe the president was on the side of the National Park Service person who he appointed, and thought this would be a good way to get more money out of Congress for that. to go. So he probably was along with it. Congress couldn't have fired him. It would have had to, or couldn't have done that. I think the executive branch would have had to order it, do it open or closed, I suppose. And but anyway, that and this is, you see this everywhere. You're going to be seeing it a lot now that state and local governments are all whining like newborn babies over a slowdown in revenue increases. In the state of Maryland, where I live, you read these articles carefully, you always find out that their spending is not actually going down. It's just increasing slower than they would like. There was an article in the Baltimore Sun, the front page, top of the front page, just last week. Maryland Governor O'Malley cutting millions from the budget. And then in paragraph 6, it actually said that the budget was $3 billion higher this year than it was last year. And so what he's cutting is nothing. And so another trick is called baseline budgeting. It's called baseline budgeting because governments will look at their budget over time. And this is spending. There's time, and they'll forecast that, in the next several years, we want the amount of spending to go up here. Say this is a state government budget, and it's $10 billion 1 year. This will be the baseline. They expect that, let's say this is 2009, and they'll just project. They'll say, well, in 2011, we want the budget to be $15 billion. Okay, well, if they get to 2010, and next year, well, let's say they're at $10 billion, and they want in 2 years the budget to be $15 billion. And that's their baseline, as they call it. But if in reality the budget is $14 billion in 2011, they will call that a $1 billion budget cut. And all the newspapers will echo this. At least in America, most newspapers are nothing more than cheerleaders for the state. And so they will faithfully do this. I've talked to reporters about this who pretend that it's impossible for them to understand this concept. impossible. So they'll call that a budget cut. That's what happened in Maryland, but that's what's called baseline budgeting. And you'll be seeing this wherever you live. If anywhere in the United States, you'll be reading a lot about this. But if you read these articles carefully, more often than not, it'll be revealed somewhere in the article that the budget actually is going up. Bill Clinton did this, and I remember a man wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal, not an article, but a letter saying, "Dear President Clinton, I will be glad to donate $10,000 to your campaign if you can show me that this year's budget is one penny less than last year's budget." Because he was talking budget cuts all the time. And of course it wasn't. It was many billions of dollars more. But that's the game. That's the game. Another aspect of democracy is politicians in a democracy tend to have a short-term time horizon compared to business people. It's business people who are often chastised for only focusing on the next quarter's profits. But if you only focus on the next quarter's profits, you won't survive in the long run in a business. What if you're competing against Bill Gates, who spends $3 or $4 billion a year on research and development? Do you really think you could compete by not taking a long view and spending a lot of money on R&D like he does, which is all future oriented? You think you could compete against him only focusing on making your bottom line look good right now, this month, right now? That's not likely to be true. You're not going to compete against the Bill Gates of the world like that. But in politics, the time horizon is very short, because in Congress in the United States, everybody's up for re-election every 2 years. And in the Senate, it's 6 years. The president is 4 years. So as far as members of Congress go, that's who has the power of the purse in the U.S. system. They're primarily interested in how people perceive them now. And that's how they get reelected. And so there's a powerful incentive to spend as much money as possible on your constituents now, and to defer into the future the costs. So when Obama just announces we're going to spend an $800 billion debt finance spending, and then another trillion debt finance spending, well, that's a perfect example of this. It's all the incumbent politicians are going this so-called stimulus bill that they passed, most of the money is scheduled by law to be spent just before the 2010 election. You know, if we're in such a big emergency, why don't they spend it all now at once? Because people like Ben Bernanke and Larry Summers know that there's a time lag involved in fiscal policy. If it is possible for government spending to affect the economy, all of their textbooks say the lag is a year and a half, something sometimes longer. So you'd think if we're in a big national economic emergency, they would want to spend it on. But no, they want to spend it because they know people will forget. If they build a post office in your town right now, and the election is not for 18 months, the voters might forget that that post office created a few temporary jobs and was a stimulus. So they want to time it right. And so the end result of that, of course, is that, in the United States, the national debt now is about $11 to $12 trillion. But if you count the unfunded liabilities of Social Security and Medicare, it's more like $80 trillion is the debt, and that's over $100,000 per person. So every new baby that's born has a six-figure tax bill attached to its big toe in the United States. If we ever were to pay that with tax money. And so that's another principle of the economics of the public sector is a short-term time horizon, even though it's corporations who are often, and there are corporations and business people who are short-sighted, but they're penalized for it. In the market, you're penalized for short-sightedness if your competitors are investing which results in R&D, which results in better products in the future for them, for their companies. You're penalized with it. But in politics, you're rewarded for short-sightedness. You get reelected. And that's how the game works. It always has worked like that. Another aspect of the economics of the public sector is the sharp differences between bureaucracy in the private sector and bureaucracy in the government sector. As you all know, in the market economy, there's a market feedback mechanism of business decision making. If you make good decisions that consumers like in terms of products and prices, you're rewarded with profits. If you make bad decisions, you're penalized with losses or bankruptcy. But since there are no profits and losses by definition in government, in an accounting sense, there is political profit in terms of power and prestige and all that, but there's no profits that are distributed to shareholders like there is in business. There's no way of measuring success in terms of the market. And so what do government bureaucracies do? Well, they tend to take the opposite approach that in one of my articles on lewrockwell.com, I called it DiLorenzo's first law of government: failure is success. That is, the worse a government agency does at performing whatever it's supposed to do, the more money it will get next year. If NASA blows up the space shuttle, the government will give it a bigger budget to do better next time. If the public schools fail for decades and decades to teach children, that's because there's not enough money in public schools, right? So we reward them with more money. If the welfare bureaucracy fails to get people out of poverty, we give them more money. And the assumption is always, well, we failed because we don't have enough money. That always has been, always will be what bureaucrats say is their problem, not enough money. It's all about the money with government bureaucrats. They claim to be public servants, but I don't know anybody who's more obsessed with money than government bureaucrats. Even the do-nothing bureaucrats that sit around and seem to do nothing all day, they're doing something. They're counting their retirement benefits. That's what they do all day. That's much more productive for society than if they were actually regulating an industry or something like that. But they're all about the money, and it's just the way bureaucracy is. So there actually is a sort of a perverse incentive in government bureaucracies because of the absence of money and profits as a measuring stick of success or failure, and that failure really is success. The worse they do, the more they get. There's also a built-in incentive in government bureaucracies to be much more labor-intensive than what is economical. Because say you're running a private garbage collection company, and you own 10 trucks, and you know, this might be the beginning of Waste Management Incorporated or something, or Tony Soprano's company in The Sopranos. I mentioned that this morning. He was supposedly a, quote, waste management expert. Well, you know, if you have two people on a garbage truck, that might be economical for a profit-maximizing firm. But a lot of city governments might have three or four or more people riding around because the jobs are political patronage jobs. Each job in government can be worth several votes to the politicians who give the jobs. That's the person who has the job. If that person is married or living with somebody, that person is going to want to vote for that politician, the brother or sister or voting age children. So depending on the family situation, you might have five or six votes for every job that you give, a government job. And now the private garbage collecting guy can't afford to do that because it eats into his profits. But with government, it's all good. It's all positive to the decision makers who overstaff. And so that's why you see there have been some famous studies of, say, Chicago public schools. I remember one study had 40 times the number of administrators than the private schools in Chicago that they have. And you know, who can do that in a private business and succeed? And so the incentives are all backwards in bureaucracy. And read von Mises' book Bureaucracy if you're interested in this whole area. It really is a classic in explaining how government bureaucracies work, especially the section. There's a section called Profit Management versus Bureaucratic Management. And it explains that when in the absence of a profit as a measuring stick of success or failure, bureaucracies usually use rules, they sort of arbitrary rules, and they have to follow the rules. And so to keep your job as a bureaucrat or to be promoted as a bureaucrat, you just have to follow all these rules, but they often have nothing to do with pleasing consumers. It's just the rules. Another aspect of economics of public spending has to do with subsidies. And of course, nowadays we call them bailouts. You know, the main subsidies we're talking about today are bailouts, subsidies for Wall Street fat cats and the United Auto Workers Union in the U.S. You know, the bailout of General Motors and Chrysler is basically subsidies for the unions that have destroyed General Motors and Chrysler. And so what do subsidies do? Well, the first thing a government subsidy does to any business like this is to sever pay from performance, because there's any company like this, for example, that gets a subsidy from the government, it's not because it performed anything, it did anything, it provided us with some sort of service or good. It's a subsidy. It's been that company or that individual has just been good at lobbying the government. Most people who get subsidies from the government are not deserving. They're just more politically effective than those of us who don't play that game and influence the government to give us some other people's money. So it severs pay for performance. So what does that mean? It means it penalizes productive people who have produced income that is taxed, and the money goes into the government coffers. It penalizes them because it taxes them, and it subsidizes less productive people who get the subsidies. You know, if they were productive, they wouldn't need the subsidies. They wouldn't, you know, if they're honest business people selling a product, there's no need for a bailout or a subsidy. So depending on the degree or the amount of subsidies in an economy, the United States right now is moving really big time in the direction of creating a tremendous problem in terms of severing pay from performance and penalizing productive, working, taxpaying citizens and giving the money to freeloading bums in Detroit and in New York City with all this money. And so what these subsidies also are going to do, these bailouts, is prolong the lives of unproductive firms that have proven that they're not very good in allocating resources in an efficient way. All these banks that have made bad loans, well, they should go bankrupt if you believe in an economy that is based on serving consumers and not serving the politically connected business class of banks. The same with General Motors, and Chrysler and anybody else who's getting these subsidies. And by the way, we don't really know much detail about who's getting these subsidies. I think it was the mayor of New York City, Michael Bloomberg, who sued. Didn't he sue the Fed to try to find out who got that $1 trillion? And a federal judge pretty much told him to go out and play in the traffic on Fifth Avenue, because they wouldn't tell him who, you know, just who got all this $1 trillion of subsidies printed up by the Fed. And so you prolong the life of unproductive and inefficient firms, and you create a moral hazard problem. That is, you encourage these banks and these car companies to be less than efficient because they know they'll get bailed out the next time. And not only them, but other companies and other industries. If you set a big precedent like this, if you fail, we will socialize the costs of failure. You'll encourage more failure. And this has been going on for quite a long time. This happened, there was a third world debt crisis in the 1980s. And the real crisis was with Citibank and some of the other big banks again. They made bad loans to unqualified borrowers in the third world. Should sound familiar. So they lent all this money to third world dictators. And surprise, the socialist economies of these third world dictatorships did not produce sufficient revenue for these loans to be paid back to the big American banks. And so there's a crisis, a third world debt crisis. And it was bailed out by the United States, the World Bank, which in the United States at that time was contributing at least a fourth of all the money, I think, to the World Bank. And so they're bailed out. But who was really being bailed out was the big American banks who made the bad loans, because the money went to the dictators who then could pay off the loans so that they could borrow more money from the same banks in the future. And so what lesson did that tell Citibank and these big banks? It's that, well, we're privates are profits are private, losses are socialized, so losses are public. It's when Citibank makes money, they don't send me a dividend check. I'm not a shareholder, but if they lose money now, I'm supposed to pay. As a taxpayer, I'm supposed to chip in and help them out. But that's what the moral hazard problem is. And in the United States, we're creating a huge moral hazard problem with these bailouts. The same thing happened. We had the third world bailout. Then we had the SNL bailout. The savings and loans got in trouble. Not all of them. There were a lot of them in the United States were very sound. But the government actually taxed them to bail out their less sound competitors, as well as taxing the taxpayers in general. They had special taxes on the savings and loan industry to bail out even the good companies, to bail out their less profitable competitors. Yes, sir, in the back row, yeah.
The lowering the barrier and that is more significant than the
yeah.
Have on the
Well, this is a good example of the lunacy of the economics profession. Ben Bernanke wrote a couple of papers when he was still a professor on systemic risk. They were totally theoretical papers that weren't really attached to real world examples of systemic risk. It was systemic risk in theory. But in the current situation, the Fed created all this risk-taking. Not only the Fed, but the entire United States government. I mean, read Tom Wood's book. I wrote long before Tom's book came out. I'd been writing about the government policy for 20 years ago. I wrote about this, that the government policy of forcing banks to make bad mortgage loans to unqualified borrowers. There was a law passed in 1977 called the Community Reinvestment Act that did exactly this. That's been 30 years, and it was revised in the early 90s and strengthened in the early 90s. And also around that same time, every agency of government, the Housing and Urban Development, the Congress, and many others declared that making housing more affordable was their goal. And so the anti-discrimination bureaucracies, they all started threatening mortgage lenders to make more loans to minorities and low-income people. The Fed even instructed mortgage lenders to ignore income of low-income borrowers. And that's why they had no document loans. And no documents meaning no income verification at all. but you had to be a low income. You had to be an unqualified borrower to have the luxury of getting a mortgage loan without providing any paperwork. If you had the best credit in America and a good income, you had to give them tax returns for 3 years and all this stuff. But if you were obviously someone who could not afford that house, no problem. You know, it's craziness. But there's one of my articles that I wrote on the web on Mises.org was quoting a Fed publication threatening banks with a fine of 1% of their net value if they didn't make these loans. And so it wasn't just the Fed. It was all these other agencies, Comptroller of the Currency, and the Office of Thrift Supervision, they all were a part of this policy. And then when the Fed lowered interest rates so much, what happens when the Fed creates a situation where interest rates are artificially lowered? Well, a lot of borrowers who were unqualified yesterday, all of a sudden, the banks, since the money supply has expanded, they have more excess reserves, which are no good to them unless they make loans with them. They can't make profits unless they first make a loan. Who are they going to lend the money to? They go to the people that they turned down last month and said, well, now we have increased ability to lend money because we have more excess reserves. We'll give you the loan now. And so, that's what the risk was. There was nothing systemic about the free market. You know, so the risk wasn't systemic in the free market. It was all these government policies that created the same with the savings and loans. When the savings and loans crisis came about, it was totally created by the government. They did what they called deregulation, but it was only partial deregulation, and they re-regulated other parts of banking. I mean, if you see the list of agencies that regulate banks, the idea that they deregulated banking in the early 80s is just crazy, because they still have literally about 30 different federal agencies that were still regulating banks. But they did deregulate a few things. In savings and loans, there was a regulation called Regulation Q. I think it's a good example of how creative bureaucrats are in thinking of names for their regulations, right? Regulation Q. It was a price control, a limit on savings accounts. You couldn't pay people more than 5%. And so when mutual funds really took off in the 1970s, where it became a situation where previously you had to have $10,000 or $20,000 to really get into the stock market. But now if you had $500 or $1,000, you could buy into a mutual fund. And at the time, heck, in 1979, 1980, you could make 17 or 20% or more on a mutual fund, whereas you could only make 5% in savings. And so there was massive disintermediation. Money just flew out the door of the savings and loans. And that created huge troubles for them. And so what did the government do? They increased deposit insurance. And the deposit insurance is a federally funded insurance program that basically says, what was the number? The number at the time was each bank account was guaranteed up to $40,000. So even if the bank went bankrupt, your $40,000 was safe. The government would pay you the $40,000. They increased it to $100,000. Okay, and so here you have these savings and loans that were in big trouble. A lot of them going bankrupt because of disintermediation caused by Regulation Q. Government's solution to the problem it caused was to increase the amount of deposit insurance. And so these banks that are in big trouble said, well, we can take on more risk now, because now if we invest in this real estate development project in Arizona with a housing development and a golf course and a lake, we don't know if anybody's going to buy any of these houses now, but we think a lot of people are going to retire and go and live there. So it's high risk. But we'll lend money and we'll charge maybe 20% interest because it is high risk investment. And they're going to do that. And so they took on a lot more risk, because if it didn't work, they're covered. Deposit insurance had been increased from $40,000 per account to $100,000 per account. And so they were induced to take on a lot more risk, systemic risk, if you will, by the government, by deposit insurance. And so you have people like Ben Bernanke writing articles about systemic risk as though this never happened. You know, there was just some magically The free market created a situation of market failure where people take on too much risk all of a sudden, you know, whereas last year they didn't, but all of a sudden. And so, and that's what he did with the current crisis. The current crisis also caused by the Fed. What's his solution? Well, more government, more power for the Fed to regulate systemic risk, which of course the Fed itself has created. You know, it sounds, I don't know, doesn't sound crazy. It sounds normal. That's how government operates.
So like does not apply to student loans.
To what?
To student loans.
Because I know a guy who probably
gets $15,000.
Yeah.
Finally gets a job
with
the government.
Yeah. Well, so student loans is a perfect example of moral hazard because it's almost a definition of moral hazard because the ostensible purpose of student loans is to make education cheaper, but it makes education more expensive because what happens is the universities say, we can raise our tuition because it's not going to harm the students. They're not going to not come because they got student loans. And then after they raise the tuition, everyone lobbies to increase the amount for the student loans because the tuition has gone up. And so that succeeds. So the government will say, well, it used to be we won't lend any more than $20,000, now we'll lend $30,000. So you pay the higher tuition, and the universities say, well, let's raise our tuition again. The students aren't paying, it's student loans. And that's been the cycle since the end of World War II in the United States. But what's that?
But you cannot default.
You can't default?
No.
Well, why not? You can't not pay? You
Oh,
yeah, okay. Yeah, well, he is defaulting.
Yeah, he defaulted,
yeah. Well, there were people who were taking out student loans. The government would lend you money at 7% and then invest it somewhere where they could make 10 or 12%, and just, you know, not even use it for college or anything like that. But that's another moral hazard problem, for sure. Unemployment insurance does the same thing as far as moral hazard goes. Unemployment insurance does the same thing. This differs state by state in the United States, but what it does, if the government tells you, I think the last time I looked into this, the average was about 60% of your income, the national average, the state unemployment insurance system will, you lose your job, you're paid, and if you qualify for unemployment insurance, they'll pay you 60% of your income for a certain number of months. It might be 6 months, might be a year. Some states, it might be a year and a half. And so when they increase the amount or the time length, they're subsidizing being out of work. They're making it easier to stay longer out of work, and they increase the unemployment rate. And so it actually increases unemployment. That's the moral hazard effect of that.
Taxed?
I think you do pay. It's different in every state, but I think it is taxed where I live. But each state runs its own unemployment insurance program. But I don't know, a lot of people do that. A lot of people stay out of work. You don't have to spend money on gas. You don't have to get up in the morning. You don't have to buy food out. You know, you can spend a lot of money on food and things, work clothing and so forth. So it's not a bad gig. It's like a sabbatical, like a paid sabbatical for anybody, unemployment insurance. And of course, they've increased that. Well, the Obama administration increased deposit insurance and they increased unemployment insurance. So also, or was it Bush that increased deposit insurance? I think it was Bush, one of the last things he did. You know, everything he did was bad. And so that was one of the last bad things he did, it seems like. One other principle about the economics of public spending, it's important to recognize that, you know, markets, in a philosophical sense, markets are inherently cooperative, and that, you know, from Adam Smith on, it's recognized that the only way to make money in business is, I think Adam Smith himself, the way he put it is, I will give you what you want, and in return, you will give me what I want. Yeah, markets are cooperative. Otherwise, we won't trade. We won't have a market. If I don't give you something that you value more than your money, and you give me your money, which I value more than the thing that I sell you, that's a mutually advantageous trade, totally cooperative. What's a corporation but a group of people who get together and cooperate for a common end to produce products and services to make money. It's so, you know, human beings argue all the time and may there be some personal conflicts, but the inherent nature of commerce is cooperation between buyers and sellers. That's otherwise commerce doesn't take place. But at the same time, the inherent nature of government is conflict because of the majority rule nature of democracy, that you can only have all or none decisions in government, in a democracy. And so there's always built-in conflict, one group imposing its will on the other. In my talk this morning, the way John C. Calhoun put it, and he was one of Murray Rothbard's favorite writers. Rothbard called him one of America's greatest political philosophers. And in For New Liberty, Rothbard cites John C. Calhoun very extensively in his chapters, writings on the state. If you read Rothbard's essay, what is it, Anatomy of the State, I think he quotes Calhoun in great length. And he looked at the age-old conflict in democracy between tax consumers versus tax payers. I guess you would call it net tax consumers and net tax payers. The top group is people who are on net get more from government than they pay in taxes, and the bottom group is people who pay more in taxes than they get in benefits. And so, and there's inherently conflict between those groups. Like in the United States today, the income tax system is set up so that until you make about $35,000 a year, you don't pay any income tax, any federal income tax. And so, everybody who makes less than that has a built-in incentive to vote, always to vote for higher taxes on other people, because they figure they'll probably have a better chance of getting some kind of government benefit if paid for by somebody else. And that's why when Steve Forbes tried to run for president, I thought his worst idea was he wanted to increase this to $50,000. And a lot of libertarians said, yeah, that's a good idea. We'll sneak it up to $200,000 someday. But then, of course, that would never happen. But what that would do, it would create an even bigger lobbying force for a bigger state, because you know everybody who made under $50,000 a year would always vote for higher taxes on everybody else, not on themselves, but on everybody else. But that's the way it works, and that's the inherent conflict that exists and will always exist. And we're in a situation in the U.S. now where the net tax consumers outnumber the net taxpayers, as far as that goes, so that our politicians can just willy-nilly go out there and make speeches about taxing the rich, and which they always, I think Obama has been defining the rich as, he started out saying anybody who makes $250,000 a year and up, but then you pay attention to what some of his advisors are saying, it's more like $50,000 to $75,000. You know, I've seen some of the articles where they're proposing to tax people. So another point I'd like to make about the economics of public spending is there's no such thing as business-like government. You often hear people make proposals to make government more business-like. Every president says this. We've got to make government more business-like. Al Gore, when he was vice president, had a commission, a better government commission, that proposed making government more business-like. But that's never possible, because government enterprises are capitalized with tax dollars. And so, you know, real businesses don't have their infrastructure and their salaries paid for with tax dollars. Bill Gates never had an ability to threaten people with prison if they didn't give him money to start up Microsoft. But if you quit paying your income tax, you will go to prison. It's a farce to think that business could ever become business. I mean, government could ever become business-like, just because of this one fact, if no other facts. Okay. And I see this all the time. When I lived in Tennessee, the head of the Tennessee Valley Authority made a big deal. He came from Nissan. He was a vice president of the Nissan Motor Corporation, and they hired him at the Tennessee Valley Authority, and he's going to make it more business-like. And so he set up like a board of directors that kind of looked like a business, and they adopted some accounting rules that businesses adopt. But of course, they had received all kinds of direct and indirect government subsidies for many, many years. And so it's not really a real business. And besides that, on top of that, you don't have the market feedback mechanism in government. Since there are no profits per se, you don't have an enterprise that is rewarded for good behavior with higher profits and penalized for bad behavior with lower profits. It just plays at profit. It has government budgets. They don't have profits, so it just doesn't work. Schools, there's been an effort to try to make schools more business-like, so to speak, but that too is doesn't work. Basically, besides that, if it's desirable for a government enterprise to be more business-like, what do you think would be the obvious rhetorical response to that claim? You had your hand up.
Just like business, if you own more stock, you
have more voting rights. Okay, that's possible. How about you?
Yes. Why should it be government?
Yeah, if you think business-like is a nice idea, well, why not turn it into a private for-profit business, whatever enterprise it is? Of course, they don't want to do that. It's a matter of power and control. But if it's desirable to be business-like, well, the private sector should handle it then. It shouldn't even be in a government if business-like is such a good idea. I'll put one footnote. Not-for-profit doesn't necessarily mean they don't make profits. It just means they don't have shareholders.
Right.
Because the university I work for is a non-profit, but I guarantee you they do everything they can to make as much money as they can.
Then the not-for-profit endowed private schools that were run by charity organizations and the government, the government schools, because they had higher, the teachers made bonuses for,
Well, you have three different kinds of enterprises. You got the for-profit. Would anyone like me to open the doors and windows to make it a little warmer in here? Well, I could make it warmer if you want. I could open the doors and windows. You have for-profit. You have non-profit. We'll quit in a minute. You have government. I've arranged for Pat to open up the fire hydrant up front and with a fire hose, and she's going to hose us all down after this class. So you can stick in there another minute. In for-profit businesses, you have competition. You have shareholders in many cases, or investors. So what are the incentives to serve consumers, to hold costs down and provide better products? Well, you have competition. You can lose business. You can go out of business. You have pressure on you by shareholders or investors if you have shareholders and investors. In the nonprofit world, you may have some competition, but you don't have shareholder pressure. You have competition for fundraising, but you may or may not have competition within what you do in a thing, depending on what it is. Sometimes they're sort of monopolistic, but you don't have this. You don't have shareholder or investor pressure. In government, government is almost always a monopoly when it sets itself up in whether it's garbage collection or schools, or at least a great deal of monopoly power. And there's certainly no shareholders. And so in terms of what kind of pressures are put on these different kinds of enterprises to be efficient and serve the customers, government is always the worst because it usually has no direct competitors. Or if it does have competitors, it's grossly unequal. If the government has a garbage collection, it doesn't pay taxes. It's everything is paid for with tax dollars, its employees, its garbage trucks. And so the private garbage collectors are at a big disadvantage. They have to come up with their own money for all this. So government tends to be the most inefficient. The nonprofits can be efficient, but since they don't have shareholders, they don't have that extra pressure that corporations or companies do. And so that's why for-profit companies tend to be the most efficient, because the market feedback mechanism is generally strongest in the private for-profit sector. It's weaker in the nonprofit sector, and it's weakest in government. In fact, the nonprofit sector, they don't really have customers. I should have put customer. Well, competition means customer pressure also. But a lot of nonprofits, not your school that you mentioned, but a lot of nonprofits don't have customers but donors. The American Cancer Society doesn't have, they don't really call the people they help customers. I mean, they don't, it's not a, pay me for a service. It's the money they have is from donors. And so it's easy for the management to sort of do whatever it wants, whether it's efficient or non-efficient, because the donors rarely make a fuss over that. But customers do. Customers are going to just walk away and go somewhere else. So that's, I guess that's the last thing I have time for. Our time is about up. And Pat Barnett is outside ready to hose us all down with a fire hose, cool us down. Okay. Thank you.